Welcome to 35 West. I'm Chris Hernandez-Roy, Deputy Director of the Americas Program at CSIS and co-host of the 35 West podcast.
With how professional the Mexican
but
government
are we ready? I don't
reform
think.
Trends in Argentina.
Right. And that's what happened.
Role at all in the NAFTA negotiation.
Welcome to 35 West. I'm Chris Hernandez-Roy, Senior Fellow and Deputy Director with the Americas Program at CSIS and the co-host of the 35 West podcast. Haiti's year-long political and security crisis entered a new phase last week when Prime Minister Ariel Henry, Haiti's acting head of state since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, announced his resignation in favor of a transition council whose primary task would be to organize elections. Henry had been in Kenya to sign an agreement for the deployment of 1,000 Kenyan policemen as part of a multinational security support mission to Haiti when the gang violence sharply escalated. His resignation was issued from Puerto Rico, where his plane was forced to land after being unable to arrive safely in Haiti and being denied from landing in the neighboring Dominican Republic. Just days earlier, gangs besieged the airport in Port-au-Prince and organized a massive jailbreak of over 4,000 inmates from one of the country's largest penitentiaries, moves which threw into stark relief the grim state of affairs for the Haitian central government. Now, Haiti faces a period of profound uncertainty, with a serious power vacuum in government, ascendant criminal groups within striking distance of the halls of state power, and increasingly narrow prospects for a long-awaited international support mission. To help us unpack these recent developments and to chart a few likely scenarios for Haiti over the near future, we are very pleased to have on this podcast Dr. Georges Fauriol, a non-resident senior associate with the CSIS Americas program. In addition to his role at CSIS, Georges is a fellow with the Caribbean Policy Consortium and a member of the think tank Haiti Steering Group, a partnership of Université Quisqueya in Haiti and the Inter-American Dialogue. He is also a senior advisor with the United States Institute of Peace. Thank you for joining us today, Georges.
Chris, thank you very much. Delighted to be here, even if the theme of our conversation is hardly uplifting, I must say.
Indeed. A very difficult situation, but one which our listeners, I'm sure, would like to learn more about. Haiti has been consistently in the news for about a year now, with many observers noting that some of the fundamental drivers of the country's instability date back decades, or even to the country's independence itself. Georges, in your opinion, what are the most proximate causes of the current escalation of violence and political upheaval? Why are we seeing this happening now?
Let me try to answer that question briefly in highlighting three factors, which I think are important here to understand where we are. First, I think your opening overview of Haiti's political scene, particularly since the assassination of President Moïse in July of 2021, provides sort of an accurate sense of a deteriorating political, security, and economic environment, that even if the circumstances of his assassination remain murky, it gives you a sense a little bit of an unsettled environment. I would add also, I think, the reminder that Haiti's political and economic governance, even by July 2021, was already on shaky grounds, since throughout much of President Moïse's tenure, since 2017, included, for example, mass demonstrations against public sector corruptions that basically shut down the economy and certainly sort of society in general for parts of 2019. So that's an important backdrop, if you will, to the current crisis. The second trigger, particularly for the current escalation of violence and political mayhem, is really the inability of Haiti's, I think, still vibrant civil society, amazingly enough, and very diverse political community to merge their differences towards a viable path out of the crisis, despite, I might add, a number of what appear to be, at least on the surface, a reasonable proposal for transition governance pathways over the last 18 months to 20 months. So in some ways, there's a lot of activity, but not the kinds of results that I think everyone has expected. And finally, I think there's a third element, which is the international community's response, including from the United States, which has been over the last 2 years at times disjointed and at times perhaps worse, arguably sort of disconnected from the reality in the streets of Haiti, all under sort of a well-intentioned policy concept that has become known as, quote, the Haitian-led solution, a thought which was based on the credible idea that past efforts by the international community had usually been imposed on Haiti, that this time one would wait for a Haitian-led solution to emerge. But in fact, that concept has essentially mutated until recently to providing support for an interim prime minister, particularly since the assassination of the president, without really providing any practical support to him towards a resolution of the crisis. So those would be the three factors that I think are worth remembering in terms of today's violent and political upheaval.
Right. And we'll get into your third response, the role of the international community, and a little bit further along in the podcast. For the moment now, I'd like to just focus for a minute or two on the recent violence. Recent events clearly showcase the breadth and depth of the security challenge in the country. Gangs are estimated to control about 80% of the capital and have metastasized from violent criminal bands into full-fledged armed political actors in the country. Current events seem to be driven by one especially prominent gang leader, Jimmy Cherizier, who goes by the colorful nom de guerre of Barbecue and has directly threatened Henri on numerous occasions in the past. What prompted Cherizier to go on the offensive now? And what would you assess his political goals to be?
Cherizier and others, including the more recent arrival on the scene of kind of a hybrid figure, maybe we can get back to later, Guy Philippe, I think all of this collectively has, in the short run, fed into a broadening popular dislike for the interim prime minister, Ariel Henry, who came into office, if you will, after the assassination of the president in July of 2021. And this unpopularity of the interim prime minister is highlighted by simply the practical outlook on daily life of many Haitians, collapsing economy, the absence of state institutions at the local level, a perception of a corrupt police, and at the political level, I think a broadening feeling by many Haitians that the inability of Haiti's diverse political community to agree to any constructive transition plan over the last 2 years, I think has given rise to a, at some level, a very understandable rejection of what is perceived as traditional leadership, and therefore, to some degree, an appeal by Cherizier and many of his gang leaders, who provide at least an alternative and to some degree a certain sense of action and satisfaction in the short run. A more strategic explanation for Cherizier and his colleagues' relative success, particularly over the past 10 days, is probably related to a strategic calculations, if you will, that they will be making or they are making to try to enable themselves to influence any political and security-related outcome that is going to come out of this crisis at some point. And Cherizier and others were obviously observing the process over the last month or two of the likelihood at some point that there would be an international security presence and therefore wanted to position themselves, I think, in a better position when that happens. To some degree, they've succeeded in that the Haitian political leaders who are responding to what is going on right now in terms of invitations from the Caribbean community to seek a solution to the crisis are in some ways hemmed in to some degree by what is happening on the ground by the likes of Jimmy Cherizier, and also fearful to some degree of appearing to be linked too closely to a despised, in transition, Prime Minister Ariel Henry.
Kenya has been embroiled in fierce domestic battles over its pledge to send a force of 1,000 police officers to help restore order in Haiti. With Henri's resignation, Kenya has said it will no longer be seeking to move this mission forward, at least until new authorities are in place in Haiti. Georges, are the Kenyans getting cold feet given the scale of the violence in Haiti and given Cherizier's actions? What other options are there for an international security assistance mission, especially with the current leadership vacuum?
I'm not quite sure they're having cold feet, but it's probably a reasonable proposition to think that the leadership in Nairobi is at least trying to think through what the implications are of their deployment to Haiti. So pausing in and of itself may be a good thing. The operational reality on the ground in Haiti is obviously mutated, certainly over the last 30 days. But in some ways, the entire enterprise was arguably already on the edge for several basic reasons. The most critical issue, I think, has always been that whether it's the Kenyans or any other force, would need a governmental partner in Haiti to work with. And with Ariel Henry's resignation and the collapse of that particular transition arrangement, what happens next, I think, is of importance to the credibility, let alone the chances of success to the Kenyan deployment. I might add quickly that there are a couple other factors here at play. Secondly, there's, I think, a somewhat of a budgetary uncertainty that remains, that overhangs over this entire enterprise. While the United States has promised significant support along with other countries, U.S. congressional support for all this remains shaky, particularly among Republicans on Capitol Hill. And there's a third concern, which I think I wouldn't underestimate, but is worth reminding everyone here, which is the deployment of 1,000 Kenyan was always perceived as only one element needed to what was initially conceived more as a support capability to the Haitian National Police, and obviously now entails something much more aggressive operationally. And while there have been other countries that have volunteered support, the Bahamas, Barbados, Jamaica, there is now some talk of Benin and others, none of this is really firm, nor in the quantity that ultimately may make a difference. And perhaps more importantly, none of this operates under a formal UN peacekeeping operation. And this is important, because what this implies is that the Kenyans, in effect, arrive, but are we going to need for intelligence, logistical, administrative support, political monitoring capability, which are sort of built into a normal UN peacekeeping operation. Even though it's been approved by the UN Security Council, this is not a formal UN peacekeeping operation. So these elements have to be added to it. A lot of it was going to be coming from the United States, Canada, and other sources. But I think this adds another additional complication to the Kenyan deployment, particularly with events of the last few days, makes those questions even more important.
Right. The sophistication and power of the gangs was on full display these past weeks with attacks on key infrastructure, including the port, the airport, and the prisons, as we've mentioned earlier. The maritime port is in particular very critical for the delivery of food and badly needed humanitarian aid. So attacks of that installation are particularly worrying. But at the same time, the gangs who were conducting this violence, they're not monolithic actors. They remain divided between and within themselves. Who are the most important players in the current Haitian security landscape? And how strong exactly are groups like Cherizier's G9 that an international mission might eventually face?
The numbers are really uncertain, and I think there's been a tendency in recent months, particularly in the media, to describe the gangs and some sort of a coordinated, cohesive group. It's actually arguably a series of fiefdoms that initially were fighting over trafficking, over kidnapping, entire neighborhoods. But as the Haitian National Police, as the Haitian government's capability has decreased, this to some degree has expanded. Some UN estimates suggest that if you were to line up all the gangs, particularly in the central part of the country, in the Port-au-Prince region, it's probably somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 strong. They're mostly men, mostly young men. In fact, in some cases, teenagers, competing in a rather violent manner over territory and different operational needs, if you will. The most notorious you've mentioned, obviously, is Jimmy Cherizier's G9, which is really kind of a consortium of gangs. It competes with the Izo gang. There's the GPEP gang with Petit Gabriel and sort of other characters of this kind. In more polite circles, these could be described basically as criminal elements. What is important at this point, however, to remember is they're fairly well armed and apparently now even are using so far unarmed drones. So there's a certain level of sophistication that has emerged, which is a bit worrisome. And in recent months seem to have a growing supply of young men who are either forced to join or simply joiners because there's really nothing else for them to do at this point. There's no other gainful alternative. So the issue of gang in some ways and growth is in part to some degree not only a political and security issue, but in some ways a sociological and economic issues, which is once there's an alternative that appears, I think many of those gangs ultimately would lose their capabilities. I think the operation in recent weeks, the growth of the gangs, is also probably to some degree tactical on their part to position themselves to be in a better negotiating position with either some form of a consensus governance that emerges at some point, let alone the arrival, which I think they assume will happen at some point, of a robust international security mission. So in some ways, their success right now is more an indication of the Haitian National Police's declining capacity and the overall paralysis at the political level in Haiti than anything else.
Earlier, you mentioned Guy Philippe, a former Haitian senator who was one of the main leaders in the 2004 overthrow of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Guy Philippe returned to Haiti last year after serving a prison sentence in the U.S. for laundering drug money. He's one of the voices that called for Henri to resign and has said he wants to be president. How do you evaluate him as an actor pursuing power in Haiti?
Guy Philippe, in some ways, is a more interesting character than Barbecue and others. He sort of falls in what I would describe as a sort of a hybrid category, a hybrid figure. He is a former Haitian army turned rebel, really, notably in the fall of the second Aristide presidency in 2004. And in some ways, that created his reputation. And he subsequently was implicated, as you noted, in several narcotics, money laundering cases, local violence that ultimately landed him in U.S. custody and jail. What's particularly perplexing in his case and potentially highlights the disjointed aspect of U.S. policymaking is how he was released from U.S. jail in late November of last year, of 2023, and sent back directly to Haiti without anyone assuming that this was a bad idea. What it has done is that it's also generated a series of scenarios among many Haitians that read a lot of logic into American policymaking and have constructed this bizarre scenario where Ariel Henry is, in fact, some sort of a tool of American policy. I don't think that's the case. But the problem, however, is that within weeks of his arrival, he had rallied portions of public opinion, which was easy to do, against Ariel Henry. And worse off, I think, had begun scaring off elements of civil society and the political party community that knew very well what Guy Philippe ultimately is capable of. And at this stage, as we speak, he is one of the controlling political elements in Port-au-Prince. And the challenge, I think, for the rest of Haitian political and civil society community, let alone international actors, including the United States, is to dream up some sort of a strategy out of the crisis that does not automatically imply Guy Philippe being at the table or influencing strongly who is going to be sitting at the table. So I think it's a challenge. As I said, I'm still perplexed by his arrival on the scene of a situation which was, in effect, extremely flammable just a few months ago. I think at this point, one should probably consider two competing options. And maybe the challenge is will be try to mediate some form of a compromise that has elements of both of those options. One of those options is, in the short run, potentially the result of the Caribbean community-led mediation efforts ongoing in Jamaica. That involves some sectors of Haiti's political and civil society communities and is proposing, in effect, what is sort of an updated version of existing ideas that have been on the table for the last 20 months or so. This includes the Montana Accord, the December the 21st agreement, which is to some degree a constituency closer to Ariel Henry and others, and all build around this notion of some form of a transition council, a presidential council that would provide an alternative leadership capability and would be drawn from a conglomerate of political and civil society actors. And this proposal in its current form would have, it's maybe significant to highlight what its function would be, because it gives you a sense a little bit of the dangers to try to achieve all of this. And one is to simply actually find a replacement for Ariel Henry, who is at this point the residing prime minister, but what happens next? And secondly, to prepare for the arrival of the international security mission. That in of itself probably divides some elements of the Haitian political community. Those are for it, those are against it. And then thirdly, to be actually the governing authority that prepares and sets the stage for a national election sometime in the future. That may actually be the only element that everyone can agree on, which everyone was to go to election. How that happens and under whose tenure is the issue that's being debated. And in fact, trying to agree to just those three elements has already led to some defections to some people that were invited to join this presidential council. This is, in some ways, arguably off to a shaky start. The alternative model is what I would describe as a variation of what happened in the aftermath of the 2004 transition after the collapse of the second Ari State presidency and the multinational intervention. And this is namely, in fact, drawing from a member of Haiti's highest court, equivalent of the Supreme Court, the Cour de Cassation, to lead an interim governance structure. This has actually the virtue of appearing to be more of a Haitian-defined approach rather than what some Haitians are already calling some sort of a foreign design negotiated arrangement, which is the presidential council idea. But depending on the 2004 model also runs a danger of potentially becoming a proxy for those that actually have influence in the streets of Haiti today. And that's kind of the Guy Philippe and others who can actually shape the outcome. Actually, at this point, Guy Philippe himself has come up with an alternative version that would involve some representation of the judicial system. It would obviously, not surprisingly, include him as a member of this alternative council of governance. So those are the two principal models, each of them right now, as we speak, on very shaky grounds, and neither of them with a particularly clear path forward. That's why I'm saying at the beginning, it requires some pretty original mediation capacity from, particularly from outside sources, to work with these alternative political actors in Haiti to come up with a solution that perhaps marries both of those ideas and somehow is able to prevent what is ultimately happening right now, which is that the Guy Philippes and some of the gang leaders being the most influential actors in these scenarios.
Well, George, given these shaky foundations that you've just described and the very complex security situation that we've talked about a little bit, how realistic is it that whatever form of government ultimately takes control, transition government that is, how realistic is it that it would be able to organize credible elections in a reasonable time frame?
I think there's maybe one area where there is consensus across, even within Haiti and across the international community, which is clearly without a solution to the security crisis, elections are a no-go. So it's really security and a governance consensus that has to be established first in a very short sequence. And then the viability of that then leads to the success of an electoral calendar. Clearly, the danger is to rush to elections under the mistaken assumption that this is an issue where everyone can agree, if you will, and is one of the demands that you hear from a lot of different Haitian politicians and also the Guy Philippes of the world, that Haiti has not had a credible election for a while. There's no one that's actually in an elected position in office these days, and that needs to be addressed. This also provides some degree of support and parallel thinking among key international actors, particularly the OAS, the UN, where there is not only capacity to actually manage those kinds of processes, but maybe a motivation to try to move the process forward as quickly as possible. But at the security level, it is just impossible to think of that at this point. And I think it's worth reminding, maybe as a closing thought here, that the voter turnout for the last two national or presidential elections in 2011 and 2016, that the overall voter turnout was below 20%. So that means that whoever gets elected at the national level is in effect being elected with a very small minority of voters and not a particularly representative one. And I think a lot of Haitians, and this is the more dangerous part of this entire question, a lot of Haitians really don't have any clear reason as to why they want to even bother to vote because the results never seem to change the situation. While the security and economic situation remains dire, at the same time, Haitians have also, I think, proven resilient and committed to fighting for their country's future. So to the degree that there's still protest and there's still social mobilization, I think, taking place under the surface, but it's not clear exactly how this is ultimately going to turn out. And I think rushing towards election at this point, I think, would be a big mistake.
One of the tragedies of the current situation, the situation really of the last few weeks in the country, has been the extent to which the international community has not acted in a pressing manner, given the urgency of the situation. While a Haitian-led solution, as you mentioned earlier, has been mentioned as a key component here, the United States, Canada, and CARICOM could likely play a far greater role in ensuring at least the security assistance piece of this puzzle. Georges, how likely is it that the acuteness of the current security challenge will jolt the international community out of its seeming stupor around Haiti? What options does a country like the United States have for helping build this international response?
Well, I think there's been a certain sense of panic which has emerged among policymakers in the United States and elsewhere that the situation in Haiti was not only deteriorating, but actually exploding. And what happens in Haiti was not going to be staying in Haiti. I think that to some degree explains, for example, the most high-level engagement on the part of the United States at a diplomatic level by, in fact, the Secretary of State himself being at least for one day in those talks in Jamaica that were led by CARICOM is an indication in some ways of the, I would argue, a level of concern that reaches the higher levels of the American government. In some ways, one could say that having the Secretary of State there for one day is an indication of either the distraction of other concerns among key actors, the United States, Canada, and others, as well as a number of priorities, as well as domestic considerations where Haiti is an issue, but is often framed in the context of another crisis or a border security question, but not in terms of its ongoing character, which is really a governance and security issue. So I think to some degree, one of the responses that I would have hoped and still can happen from the American government is actually the appointment of a special envoy, special advisor, or someone within the U.S. bureaucratic structure that one can point to when it comes to Haiti. And I think part of the problem that the administration has had is to some degree a messaging problem. Who actually speaks on behalf of Haiti has not been a very clear issue. And I think that has confused a lot of audiences, including those in Haiti, who have read into this, that at the end of the day, the United States is not going to do anything. And I think that's an issue that applies not only to the gangs, but also to a lot of other Haitians who are disappointed, if you will, by the U.S. and international response so far. Having said that, I think there may be more going on under the surface than we assume. The preparation for the arrival of the Kenyans, although delayed for the last several months, has actually been energized by a lot of behind-the-scenes effort at coordination of strategy. The Kenyans were here in Washington several times during the fall. Southcom, who has experience in operations in Haiti, has been engaged. This involves intelligence, security, logistics issues. So I think there's actually more behind the scenes than we think and may be visible. The arrival in the last few days of a highly specialized Marine platoon to protect the U.S. Embassy facility in Port-au-Prince, I think to me is a signal that there's maybe more than what has officially been announced. So this leads me to suggest that at some point there may be more active support on the part of the United States and maybe other actors. But clearly, this is almost too little too late at this point. And the question, I think, for U.S. diplomacy at this point is also going to be able to continue the active engagement of other actors, the Kenyans of the world, but also in some degree, the Caribbean community that ends up at this point with not much result in terms of its latest initiative, even though Haiti is a member of CARICOM, that has not actually borne a lot of positive results at this point. The other thing I want to keep an eye on is the ability of the administration in election year to, I think, realize that it's in some ways advantageous to deal with the Haitian crisis now than it is to deal with the implications of a more explosive outcome 3-4 months down the road when it clearly then becomes an electoral point of dispute and debate.
Georges, while assistance from abroad is critical to get a hold of the security situation, international assistance is certainly no silver bullet. When considering options for security for Haiti, what guardrails should be in place to ensure accountability on the part of the intervening mission? This is especially important given problems with past interventions in Haiti.
Well, I think there may be two or three different things that are worth mentioning here at a very general level. Your question becomes quite important because, unlike past interventions in a multinational peacekeeping operation that come along with sort of an apparatus that is framed by a lot of different actors, including ready-made experiences and procedures through the UN and other actors, this has to be built into the process. And there's already been some questions, even from Kenyans themselves, about the credibility and shall we say, checkered a record, particularly at the human rights level, of the Kenyan police and security forces. So that needs to be prevented, obviously, in a deployment in Haiti by them and anyone else. The danger that ultimately you run into is those kinds of issues becoming, in effect, the tagline for this latest intervention by the international community, let alone the loss of casualties by these groups very quickly, early on, if you will, because of a lack of preparation. The other issue in some ways that has to be in place is a clear-cut, as I mentioned, a clear-cut funding support, which frankly is a little fuzzy at this point. And I'm a little still not quite clear how all these pieces come together, despite announcement more recently that there's additional U.S. support. I don't see the political support behind it. Yet maybe the sense of panic, I think, that has now run through clearly elements of the international community, including the U.S. administration, that actually may lead to a broader realization that Haiti isn't going to go away. It needs to be dealt with in a serious manner. The third element, I would say, and is one where I would still hope that there are mediation efforts underway. It can be through private means. It can be through a sort of indirect sources to deal with key actors in Haiti itself. I'm still hopeful that there is a energetic, if divided and at times divisive, Haitian civil society capability and political community of people who want to try to do their best. But I think right now it needs a little external inspiration and encouragement. And I think this is where you need some credible intermediaries. There's been some of that done through Jonathan Powell, the British sort of somewhat mysterious former British diplomat who's been in and out of Haitian mediation efforts over the last 2 years. It could be others. It could be the Norwegians. It can be some trusted partners within the Caribbean. It could be some Americans or Canadians who are very familiar with the Haitian situation. For example, the former Governor General of Canada, Michael Jones, herself of Haitian descent, is well known in the Haitian community. Someone that can ultimately work privately and behind the scenes with Haitian civil society so that the external input in the security side ultimately supports also a consensus among Haitians themselves. The problem with all of this, it requires a lot of heavy lifting and work, including some of it here in Washington, and I'm not quite sure I see that yet helping.
Josh, thank you very much for sharing your insights on the complex situation in Haiti with our listeners. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today on the 35 West podcast.
And that's it for this week's edition of 35 West. We hope you enjoyed listening and that you'll stay tuned for future episodes.